faith-inspiring radio. This is UCB Ireland.
Welcome to another edition of How on Earth Did We End Up Here with Nick Park, Director of EA Ireland, Evangelical Alliance Ireland, and Senior Pastor at Solid Rock Church in Drogheda. Hello, sir. How are you?
I am feeling great today.
Into the final episode and the final edition of what we're going to talk about, church history. It has been a fantastic journey.
I've enjoyed this immensely. I'm going to miss having these chats with you, Robbie.
Well, it's been. I want to say, first of all, thank you for writing the book. Because for too long, people assume they know what's going on or what has gone on or how did that happen. Oh, yeah, I know. But this has been a real, real journey. And it has been fantastic to be part of it with you. And we're into chapter 15 and 16, the very end of the book. And we're going to talk now about fundamentalists, Pentecostals, and much more besides. So, Nick, where do you want to start?
Okay, well, first to say this, that sometimes history is easier to understand the further away from it you stand.
Okay.
You know, see, you can look at something that happened 1,000 years ago and say, yeah, that happened, and because of that, this happened. But sometimes when it's right up close or even you've lived through the events, it's a bit harder to judge it objectively and to realize the significance of it.
Sure.
Sometimes things that seem really, really important at the time turn out to be not very important down the line.
Right. Okay.
With the benefit of hindsight. But if we look back over the 20th century, we can see four huge stories taking place that would change the face of Christianity. And the first one of these is the battle between liberalism and fundamentalism.
Okay.
You see, at the end of the 19th century, you had a rise of theological liberalism that was basically saying, nobody believes the Bible anymore. Intelligent people can't believe in miracles and all this kind of stuff. And if we just take away all the supernatural out of Christianity and bring it down to a message that let's all try to love one another and can't we all get on, then the church might survive.
Right.
But it hasn't worked out like that. You see, at the beginning of the 20th century, you had all these people who, they've held very loose ideas of biblical authority and biblical inspiration, and it was quite a vague gospel. And it said that basically people are getting more educated, the world's getting better, we're going to enter into this golden age of peace and prosperity. And then you had the First World War.
Right.
And it shattered all of that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you had these millions of people dying, and then, you know what, things didn't get better after that. You had economic depression, and then you had the rise of the Nazis, you had the Holocaust, you had the Second World War, and straight on into the Korean War, and there's been a war going on somewhere ever since.
Yeah, since the beginning of the Second World War, we've not had, I suppose, a decade or even 5 years without war somewhere.
No, there's always a war going on somewhere. And here's the thing. Those nations that were the most educated, the most influenced by centuries of Christian teaching, they actually proved themselves to be more capable than anyone else of committing atrocities. And so this idea that the world was getting better and better and we could just forget about the gospel as such, it was seen to be totally unrealistic. Now, and then there was a controversy took place in the Presbyterian Church in the United States in the 1920s. And it actually mirrored what was going on in many other mainline Christian denominations. You had a growing liberalism and turning away from a literal belief in the Bible. But then you had a group of ministers within the denomination who said, you know what, there's certain fundamentals we've got to hold to. Mm-hmm. And the five fundamentals that they mentioned were these. First of all, the inspiration and authority of the Bible, that it's God's word.
Yeah.
The virgin birth of Christ. Christ's death as an atonement, paying for our sin. The bodily resurrection of Jesus and the reality of the miracles. And these, for them, were the five fundamental truths that they saw as being under attack. And that if you left these behind, what you were left with wasn't worth calling a church. And this was actually when the term fundamentalism first began to be used.
Yeah.
Now, today, of course, the word fundamentalism and fundamentalist changed beyond all recognition. It's a term of abuse now. If you want to insult somebody, you call them a fundamentalist.
Yeah, I was going to say that today we don't see it as a positive thing at all.
No, No, because it's developed a different meaning. But originally, it just meant a fundamentalist was somebody who believed in the Bible, believed in the virgin birth, believed in the death of Christ on the cross, his resurrection, and the miracles of Christ. That was it. So most Christians that I know today would, at that time, fundamentalist. But eventually, the fundamentalists lost their battle. And they left the Presbyterian Church in America and set up their own denomination. And it looked as if liberalism had won the day. But actually, looking back at this nearly 100 years later, we see that the opposite was the case, because the denominations which bought into this liberal approach of chucking away the stuff they didn't like in the Bible, those are the denominations that have declined numerically. They're the denominations that basically have fallen apart. And the denominations and churches and the forms of Christianity that have grown, and often grown very spectacularly, have been those that affirm those fundamental doctrines. And a lot of this growth has occurred through evangelicalism. Evangelicalism is related to fundamentalism, but it's different, not so much, again, in doctrinal belief, but more in style and approach. Mm-hmm. Fundamentalism was very much defensive. It was very much saying, the world's attacking us. Let's, you know, pull up the drawbridge, close the gates.
Yeah.
Let's try and preserve what we've got. Whereas evangelicalism has been much more proactive and self-confident and saying, let's go into the world.
It's evangelistic.
Yeah. So for example, Billy Graham best summed this up as, you know, when you look at the rise of evangelicalism, somebody like Billy Graham, who was not trying to keep the bad world out, but was going into the world to change the world. Yeah. And that would be the main difference in how we use the terms today with fundamentalist and evangelical.
Good to know how we could do that.
That's why I'm the director of the Evangelical Alliance and not the Fundamentalist Alliance.
Yeah, true. But you do go out, don't you? You do a lot of travel personally yourself.
Yes.
And you do go and bring the gospel wherever you go.
Because we believe it's the message that's worth proclaiming everywhere. And we can be confident that if we have the freedom to proclaim it, it will make a difference.
Yeah.
Now, there was a famous book published in 1973 in the United States by a guy called Dean Kelly. And he wrote a book called Why Conservative Churches Are Growing. Now, this guy Kelly, he was not a fundamentalist. He actually belonged to a liberal church.
Uh-huh.
He was a liberal minister. He was a board member of the American Civil Liberties Union. He was an outspoken opponent of allowing prayer in schools. But he did some research and he pointed out a truth that nobody wanted to admit. And it was this: that the congregations and denominations that held most closely to the Bible were the ones that were growing. This idea that, you can't expect people to believe that stuff anymore, let's just chuck all that out. When you did that, it didn't bring people to faith. It actually drove them away.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would see that as just like, right, as opposed to the power of the gospel changing people's lives.
Yeah. But the fact is that it's been conservative churches, the closer that they stick to the Bible, the more they tend to grow. And that's been proved again and again. It's happening all over the world. And it's happened. We can see it happening consistently over a period of 50 years or more.
Yeah.
And it's the same here in Ireland. You know, nominal Christianity is in decline in the effects of the people that just call themselves a Christian but don't really believe half of it.
Sure.
Whereas those churches that actually say we do believe the Bible and we believe the Word of God and we believe in miracles, we believe in the power of Jesus, those tend to be the churches that are growing.
For me, it's one of those things you think, I get it, I understand it, it's what I know, it's what I see, it's how I've lived. But I fully understand that those that have taken their foot off the gas, as it were, just kind of coast. And that's all it does. It just coasts.
Yeah, because ultimately, if you don't believe that the gospel has the power to totally transform your life, why would you bother with it? What's the point of going to church if half the stuff in the Bible isn't true anyway and it's not going to really make a dramatic difference to your life? Why would you bother?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's just, get on with what I do normally.
So this battle between liberalism and a more biblical Christianity has been one of the stories of the 20th century, and a surprising story in many people's view. They didn't expect it to end the way it did.
Right.
Now, the second big story of the 20th century was the rise of Pentecostals and Charismatics and that wing of the church. Because actually, when you go back to the year 1900, mm-hmm. you have a tiny handful of people who would be what we today describe Pentecostals, Charismatics. By the time you get to the end of the 20th century, 100 years later, you're talking about 600 million people, or about 10% of the world's population at that time. And that is actually the fastest non-military movement, either religious or non-religious, in the entire history of the human race. Never has a single ideology grown so rapidly in the space of one century.
Wow.
And a theologian called Harvey Cox described Pentecostalism, and these are his words, a spiritual hurricane that has already touched nearly 500 million people and an alternative version of the human future whose impact may only be in its earliest stages today. Actually, the growth of Pentecostal charismatic Christianity has affected all of us. I mean, even if you're not a Pentecostal or a charismatic, it's quite likely that even the songs that you sing in your church have been dramatically altered by Pentecostal churches, such as Hillsong and things like this. So it's actually had this huge impact on global Christianity. It's affected the way that we worship. We've seen evangelists such as Reinhard Bonnke take the mass crusade methods of Dwight Moody or Billy Graham and use them to pray for healing and reach, again, much larger crowds. I mean, you've had Reinhard Bonnke holding evangelistic meetings in Africa where over 1 million people gather in a single service. I myself have stood in a church building in Africa. I visited some while ago the Redeemed Christian Church of God campground in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And there was a building there that seats 1 million people. It's 1 kilometre long, 1.5 kilometres wide. Now, I've told people about that. And some people have said to me, look, prove it. You know, I don't believe it. So last time I was in Nigeria, I took my video camera with me. And I was filming this building, standing, panning the video camera along. And a member of the staff came up to me and said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I've told people back in Ireland about this huge building, which is actually the largest building on earth of any description
really?
In terms of the footprint area it covers.
Wow.
And I said, I've told people about this back home. No, they won't believe me. He said, well, have you been to the new building yet?
Okay.
And I said, what do you mean? He said, we're building a new building that's much bigger because this one's too small.
No.
And I went and it's 3 kilometres by 3 kilometres. To give you an idea of that, think of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
Yeah.
It could fit in there over 47 times.
No way.
I mean, this thing is absolutely massive.
And they get it full?
Yeah, there is an annual Holy Ghost prayer meeting
that
takes place on that site that 3.5 million people attend. So this is the kind of growth we're talking about beyond anything Christians had ever imagined before. And we've seen as well that these churches can be so adaptable. And, you know, in different countries, they develop in different ways, often under very gifted national leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, again, has been a big story in the 20th century church. And really linked with that, and we're already straying into this, is not just the rise of Pentecostalism and the Charismatics, but also the Global South.
This is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because this is, although you have very large churches in many European countries and in North America, I mean, look, I've been to Hungary and stood in a church of 20,000 people in Budapest.
Yeah, you know, massive.
So these things are happening all over Europe and all over North America, but particularly in the Global South. At the beginning of the 20th century, Christianity was seen predominantly as a European and North American religion that had missions in other places in the world.
Okay.
But those missions programs, often they were still controlled by Westerners. And in Africa, for example, Islam was seen as the dominant religion. And what most people were forecasting was that Africa would become an entirely Muslim continent. But that's not what has happened. As colonial nations became independent, what actually happened was many of the people who helped those nations escape from colonialism and led the independence movements, mm-hmm. they were actually people who had received their education in missionary schools. And so the Christian faith gave indigenous peoples the courage and self-confidence to take on the empires that had governed them. And particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, tens of millions of Christians now belong to churches and denominations that are led by Africans. And even in more traditional denominations, the numbers of African members far outweigh those in Europe and North America. So for example, take Anglicans, right? If you take the Anglicans or Episcopalians, as they're known in America, there are more Anglicans in Nigeria than in all of Europe and North America combined.
When you start talking figures, it just blows your mind.
Yeah. And also now, not only has Christianity become the dominant religion in Africa, but African ministers now lead the largest congregations in some European countries, including Belgium, including the Ukraine, including the UK. So you've got this incredible move from the global south. In Asia, it's even more dramatic. If you go to Seoul, South Korea,
okay,
and look out over the city at night, it's impossible to miss all the crosses, because the churches in South Korea, in Seoul, uh-huh. they all put these neon crosses up on their buildings.
Okay.
And as you look out over Seoul at night, all you see is crosses after crosses after crosses with the churches that have spread, including the largest single church congregation in the world, the Yodo Full Gospel Church.
In South Korea?
In South Korea, led by Paul Yonggi Cho.
Okay, yeah.
Some years ago, I visited that church. I went to their early morning prayer meeting.
Right.
Turned up at 5 a.m. in the morning for the early morning prayer meeting, wondering if anybody would be there. And I found there was already 25,000 people there praying at 5 in the morning.
Whoa.
So, you know, you have Indonesia. Indonesia is known as the largest Muslim nation in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But you have indigenous Indonesian churches which attract millions of members, sometimes over 100,000 in one congregation in the largest Muslim nation in the world.
I love this because here we are, you know, 2,000 years since Christ, and the church has gone through so many different variations. Yeah. It's gone through so many battles. It's gone through so many changes, almost lost, not lost, almost forgotten, but brought back. And here we are now, today, this century, this decade, and we're seeing massive growth. And it's only when we talk about it like this, and you talk about 25,000 people at an early morning prayer meeting in South Korea. You can't get four people sometimes to an early morning prayer meeting here. But 25,000 people, and you think the gospel is alive.
Yeah.
The gospel is active, and the gospel is doing something across the world.
It is. And perhaps the most remarkable story comes from China.
Uh-huh.
Because before the Communist Revolution, centuries of missionary endeavor had brought only a tiny percentage of the Chinese people to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And under Chairman Mao, every effort was made to eradicate religion. And most Western observers thought, that's it, the church is finished in China. All the good work the missionaries has done, it's been undone,
mm-hmm.
the gospel's finished. And yet, what happened was a network of underground, unregistered house churches began to spring up all over China. No missionaries, led by the Chinese people themselves. And basically, once the doors began to open again and things began to loosen up a bit in China and missionaries were able to go in once more,
mm-hmm.
they found this, that the largest church growth that has ever occurred in history had been taking place in China. And estimates vary, but even conservative estimates say that there are now at least 100 million believers worshipping in the underground churches
really?
In China, which is close to 10% of the entire population of the country.
That's incredible.
It really is amazing, and they've done it in the face of severe persecution, and it's been their own model of doing church. They've not followed the Western way of doing church because a different model has been forced upon them.
Uh-huh.
It's been small, underground house churches where this has happened.
And they've just, and it's how, what's the figure again?
100 million believers.
That's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
It truly is. In Latin America, which of course was once, after the conquistadors, was very solidly a Catholic continent.
Yeah.
Pentecostalism has seen enormous growth, particularly among the oppressed and the downtrodden, who felt let down by the official church. Now, some people would not view this as overall Christian growth. They would say, well, they're just moving from one form of Christianity to another. But most of us, you know, I think listening to this program, we would see Christian as not just being somebody who was born into a denomination. We'd see it as somebody who's made an active commitment to follow Jesus in their life.
Yeah.
And certainly what's happening in Latin America in terms of people entering into a personal relationship with Jesus, it's up there ranking alongside Africa and Asia in terms of dramatic gains. And so by the time you get to the end of the 20th century, the center of world Christianity had unmistakably shifted from the north to the south and from the west to the east. And today, most of the world's Christians now live outside of Europe and North America. And that process is only going to continue.
It makes us stand up and kind of take account of where we're at.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are we not doing right?
Mm-hmm.
So that we would have the same growth, so that we would have the same, I suppose, we would see miracles. We would see people's lives changed. Yeah. Why are we not seeing that?
Well, I mean, obviously, people will have different ideas as to why that is. I do believe that one of the major reasons why we've been held back in North America and Europe has been the influence of Christendom, has been the fact that the church has been seen as the powerful,
okay,
and those in authority, and those that are stifling freedom and trying to enforce their views on others. Whereas in these other parts of the world, it's where a minority faith has come from the margins. And instead of trying to use the law to force other people to behave like Christians, the church has had to just preach the gospel to the majority.
Yeah.
And you know what? When you just preach the gospel, you do see results. And that's why some of the developments, and we're going to come to this in just a moment, but some of the developments that we see taking place in Western society, and sometimes we see it as society falling apart and dying for the good old days, may actually be creating the same environment where we can see the same kind of spectacular advance of the gospel. But I do want to talk about some problems and some warning signs in among this growth.
Yeah.
Because you can't just pretend it's all good news. And one real warning sign happened in Rwanda.
Okay.
Because by the mid-1990s, one of the success stories, so-called success stories in Africa regarding church growth was Rwanda. Because it got reached a stage where over 90% of the population claimed to be Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in 1994, they descended into genocide as members of one tribe, the Hutus, began massacring the minority tribe, the Tutsis, and they killed an estimated 800,000 people in less than 100 days.
Wow.
I mean, it was horrific. Many of the mass killings occurred in church buildings, and many were actually perpetrated by members of churches, including nuns and clergy.
Wow.
So what went wrong? And the answer is actually, it should not surprise us, it was the idea of Christendom again. Because there was this cozy relationship between the Rwandan churches, the established churches, and the Hutu government.
Yeah.
And the churches in Rwanda had so wedded themselves to the power and structures of the state that to be a Christian often meant little more than I've been born into Africa's most Christian country. So a nation in the global south had created a new Christendom that turned out to be every bit as murderous as the European Christendom that created the Crusades or the Inquisition. And
it's gone full circle.
Yeah, and you know what? We can see similar warning signs in Uganda, where Christian, and I've got that in inverted commas, Christian members of Parliament, urged on by preachers, actually passed legislation, for example, imposing the death penalty on people for homosexuality. Now, thankfully, that law was changed, less stringent, but still very draconian. And Christianity, of course, Christianity should promote high moral standards and holiness among its members. But to try to impose that on non-Christians and to try to use force and violence to do so is profoundly un-Christian. And that's one of the major differences between Christendom and Christianity.
I'm fascinated that we've come full circle. That in past programs, we've heard of this. We've heard of rules changing and man's take on things, bringing rules that it's crazy. This, and here we are again.
Yeah, there is a very powerful film called God Loves Uganda. And it's very, very sobering for any Christian to watch this film. But it basically chronicles how this came about in Uganda. And that sadly, it was often Western missionaries that were there whipping up the people in Uganda to pass these laws that would impose the death penalty on homosexuals. It really grieved me, and I believe it would grieve Jesus what went on there. Now, in one way, I would say, thankfully, we've seen Christendom collapsing in the West. And,
yes.
And this is the other big story of the 20th century. Is the decline in the official influence of the church on society. Because what we've seen in Europe is basically the church no longer runs society. Now, in North America and the US, maybe still a little bit more, but that's fast changing. So what's happened in Europe is happening in North America as well, very quickly. Now, of course, in the United States, it was a different form of Christendom than in Europe. In Europe, Christendom intended to be enshrined in the law. So you have the Church of England bishops who still have seats in the House of Lords.
Yes, yes.
In England. Now, in the United States, you had the official separation of church and state, but still you had this great influence of religion on society and often still passing laws that would try to enforce Christian morality on unbelievers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, basically, Christendom has pretty well collapsed in the Western world. And I've said this before in a previous program that sometimes we hear Europe being described as post-Christian. I don't believe it is post-Christian. I believe genuine Christianity is growing in Europe.
Right.
In terms of people that are freely making a choice to follow Jesus. But this idea where Christendom has the dominant hold over society, that is definitely gone in Europe now. And so what's happening in Europe is those forms of Christianity that are the most demanding in terms of commitment and adherence to the gospel and the fundamentals of the faith, those are the forms of the faith that is growing. And actually, the secularism that we see here can be a positive rather than a negative. Because if we really believe the gospel is true, and really is superior to every other message, then if there's a level playing field for everybody, that's going to help us, not hinder us.
I've always gone on the basis that if the Son shall set you free, you shall be free indeed.
Yeah.
Scripture, okay? So we don't have to justify the Bible. It justifies itself. It stands for it. Now it's right for us to get out there and tell people about Jesus.
Yes.
But I don't personally, this is my own personal thing, I don't get myself all mixed up or think the Bible can't defend itself. Yes, it can.
Yeah.
And I like that thought of everybody on a playing field and then watch the one that rises.
Yeah.
Watch the true message of Christianity that stands tall and becomes that beacon of light again.
You see, if you believe that your faith cannot thrive and grow without being artificially propped up by the law of the land, then you are not really confident that your faith has the power to transform lives. In fact, let's face it, the greatest growth that we've seen, when we look back over church history, and we've been on a roller coaster ride through it and
yes,
in these eight programs.
Yeah.
But the greatest growth that was ever seen, it occurred in the Roman Empire under persecution.
Yeah.
It's occurred in China under persecution. And in fact, whenever we don't have the state supporting us and enforcing our views, that's actually when the gospel grows the fastest, when we're a minority, when we're persecuted.
I always remember it said about World War II that at the time of the Blitz, Londoners, whilst they were down in their tube stations and so forth, away from the bombs, a lot of Londoners turned back to the gospel.
Yeah.
A lot of people turned to prayer because it was a last resort. It was like, we've got nothing else, so we've got to get to praying again.
Yeah.
And things happened.
Same thing happened in the United States after 9/11. Church attendance went through the roof.
Yes, it did.
For a few months.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people, unfortunately, and sadly, they attended churches looking for something and didn't find what they were looking for. But certainly in times of trouble and times when you feel under attack, people do turn to the gospel. But this really is, if you like, the fourth big story of the 20th century church. You've got the liberalism and fundamentalism. You've got the rise of Pentecostals and charismatics. You've got the rise of the global south. And you've got the collapse of Christendom in the West.
Yeah.
And now, does that mean that in the global south we're going to see a new Christendom? I don't think we are. Now, it did happen in Rwanda because you had one or two denominations that held the power there.
Uh-huh.
But in most parts of the global south where Christianity is growing, there isn't one church that holds sway.
Right.
You've got loads of different churches. And I find this rather interesting because sometimes people complain about this, how terrible it is that we're divided into all these different denominations and churches. But actually, there's a safeguard there.
There is. There's a good thing in that.
Because when we have a lot of different churches, one church doesn't get all the power. It doesn't link itself with the government. It doesn't start acting intolerantly. Because to be quite honest, we as Christians don't always handle political power well. And it seems like we do a better job of representing Jesus when we're on the margins of society and we can speak as a prophetic conscience to society rather than being the guys who are controlling things. But one of the things that we can see with this secularism is it's been a different kind of secularism than what people had predicted. You know, way back in the 1960s and even the 1970s and the 1980s, sociologists basically said religion is finished. They said society, as it becomes more secular, there's going to be no place for religion anymore. You'll find a few minority groups huddled together here or there, and that's it. Now, actually, that isn't what's happened. Instead, you've seen megachurches arise.
Yeah,
you've seen
churches.
Religion still play an important role in so many people's lives. So the way that secularism has played out has been very different. And secularism hasn't meant the destruction of religion altogether. Secularism has rather meant a society where people are free to be non-religious, but also increasing numbers of people do choose to be religious and do choose to have a faith. So it's actually the sociologists have really been confounded on this. People who said that God is dead have instead had to turn around and say, hey, God is still very much alive.
Your sound, your station, UCB Ireland.
So, Nick, as we enter into, I suppose, what is our last conversation, last little part of the conversation on the book, How on Earth Did We End Up Here? Where do we go from here? This is the question. You know, what happens now?
This question is the reason why I started out to write a book on church history in the first place.
Okay.
Because I figured there's no point in working out where you're going next until you understand where you are now and how you got there.
Good point.
So based on all that we've looked at, where do we go from here? You know, there is something called counterfactual history.
Okay.
Counterfactual history is basically the what ifs. What if this event hadn't happened.
Okay.
And we can do that personally. What if your mother hadn't met your father?
Yes, all that sort of stuff.
What if your dad had missed that train and it didn't end up meeting your mum?
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you have movies like Back to the Future and everything that were based on this premise. But historians like to play these games, you know, and they like to say, what would have happened if the Spanish Armada had actually conquered England?
Yeah.
And the King of Spain had ended up being the king over England as well. You know, would you then have had the United States, or would you have had basically Latin America?
Mm-hmm.
Would have also been the experience of North America as well.
Yeah.
So historians, now again, a lot of it's guesswork. You know, you play these games. You know, I like to think about, What if the Montanists, the early Christians who were basically suppressed because they believed in the gifts of the Holy Spirit and prophecy, what would have happened if they had been tolerated and allowed to continue? Or what if the Celtic Church had been left alone for a few more years, a few more centuries,
to
develop
so
its distinctive kind of Christianity? Mm. Or the Nestorians that took the gospel out to China and Japan and India, what if they hadn't been condemned as heretics by the Western Church and they'd been supported and helped? Mm. You know, it's fascinating to try to think about these things. But the what-ifs that I'm thinking about now are not the what-ifs of the past, but the what-ifs of the future.
Okay.
You know, what if we do it this way? What if we do it that way? Back in 2010, I attended something called the Third Lausanne Congress on World Evangelization, which was a gathering of over 5,000 Christian leaders from around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And they gathered in South Africa, in Cape Town, and really talked about, how did we get here?
Yeah.
And where are we going next?
Yeah.
And now I have to say, listen, I was a very small cog in that event. You know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend to the listeners of UCV Ireland that I was one of the main speakers at that event. I was a very small delegate among 5,000 others. But there were several things that I noticed that I think affect how we move on into the future. One was, there was a lot of speakers from different parts of the world, but most of the speakers from the Global South, they were people who had been educated and mentored in either the UK or the US. So their passports may have come from different countries, but they still very much represented Western Christianity. And we need to say, moving on into the future, how much is British and more importantly, American Christianity going to keep influencing Christianity in the rest of the world?
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be allowed to develop in its own ways, or is it going to be a mirror image of what happens in the United States? And one of the factors that is probably influencing this now today is the whole phenomenon with the current US president.
Yes.
And I'm not going to get into the details of...
We won't get into whether you like him or not.
...discussing whether you like him or not, or whether, you know. But the fact is, you now have this situation where you have a very controversial US president, and the perception is that the evangelicals have put him there. The Christians have put him in that place.
Yeah.
That's not actually as true as the media portray it, because one thing people don't realize is that whenever we hear about evangelicals, that in American political discourse, when they say evangelicals, they mean white evangelicals.
Right, okay.
So when they say 60% of evangelicals voted this way, they're not talking about African Americans. They're not talking about Hispanics.
They're just talking about white.
About whites.
Yeah.
So that creates this skewed image that the Christians have put this president in power.
Yeah.
But then you have in other countries of the world where there's a very negative perception of this president and the people who put him in power. And so there is in many parts of the world a desire of churches to distance themselves from the church in the United States. And it's going to be very interesting to see whether that's just a temporary thing or whether that's going to continue to play out.
Right.
And what you're generally happening is this, is very often the influence of the United States on other countries comes down to finance. Because while the majority of the world's Christians now live in the Global South, the majority of the finance owned by Christians in the world is still in North America.
Right. Okay.
And what you are seeing is that churches, for example, in Europe that maybe aren't as dependent on US dollars are often becoming more and more different from how the churches look in the United States. But there are churches in other parts of the world that very much rely on US dollars.
Yes, they do.
And so they will toe the line of how the American missionary organizations tell them they should behave.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how that all is going to play out, but I think it's going to be fascinating and it's going to be pivotal for the future of world Christianity. So watch this space.
Okay.
A couple of other things I want to mention. One was that at this Lausanne Congress, there was some tension between Pentecostals and non-Pentecostals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's something in Ireland. We're really seeing that melting away. You know, I'm seeing in Ireland, example, Baptists and Pentecostals working together and cooperating together much, much more. But what happened at this Lausanne conference was that they had a video showing the great church growth there has been over the 20th century. But it didn't say much about the Pentecostals, even though they've been the major part of that growth. So there's still some tensions there that probably need to be sorted out. Also, there were people talking about what we call the health and wealth gospel, with a very strong emphasis on healing and prosperity.
Yeah.
And again, at this Congress, a lot of evangelical leaders were putting that down and saying this is a bad thing. And yet a lot of the growth that has taken place around the world has been in churches that do preach a prosperity gospel and do put a strong emphasis on providing people's needs and prospering them and healing.
But then the Bible says, my God shall supply all my needs.
That's
now,
correct.
We can't take that out of context because the full verse is according to his power within us, yeah, and his riches within us, yes? So. And it's also, my God shall supply all my needs. What do we determine as need and what do we determine as, oh, I'd like one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, a very big difference. But it's
and prosperity as well, you see, is relative.
Yes, it is.
When we see somebody as prosperous, that means different things to different people. I mean, I remember going out and doing some work in what's called the Middle Belt of Nigeria, which is quite an impoverished area. It's the interface between the Muslim North and the Christian South. And we were working with some villages there. And as part of the work we were doing, we were digging wells in places where there's no running water. But we also were able to purchase some cheap Chinese motorcycles and even some bicycles that we gave to pastors there so they could do
their
work
do the job,
more effectively.
Yeah.
I remember this pastor praying with tears of joy about how blessed he was and how God had prospered him because he now had a bicycle.
It's incredible.
And I'm, as a pastor in Ireland, I'm thinking if I was forced to have to ride a bicycle instead of drive my car, I would be crying out to God saying, God, what did I do wrong that you're punishing me? So our views of prosperity are relative.
It's a cultural thing as well, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I think the emphasis that you put on it as well is you know, that's an important thing. So, for example, people sometimes say to me, well, what about how do you feel about the prosperity gospel? And the answer I always say is this. I say, I don't believe in the prosperity gospel, but I believe in gospel prosperity. I believe that when I put the gospel first, that God does meet my needs.
Yes,
the Bible says, you know, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these other things will be added unto you. But I think the problem is when, and this is what some people find very disturbing, is when it becomes the focus.
Yes.
And it becomes one of the main focuses that things get distorted.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's an issue that's going to have to be dealt with. And this distorting influence of wealth is something. It used to be that in many countries, particularly here in Ireland, we used to look at the church in North America and think they've really got it together.
Yeah.
And we used to say, you know what, if we work hard enough and pray hard enough and have enough faith, maybe one day our churches can look like the churches in America. But actually, when you take this longer view of church history that we've been taking here, you realize that the changes that are taking place in Europe are happening ahead of the changes that are happening in North America.
Yes.
We're actually ahead of the curve in what's happening in society.
Yeah, we are.
And how the church adapts to it. And so what I'm seeing is the church in other countries becoming much more confident in how God is leading them. And instead of feeling they've got to copy what they see in the United States, they're actually saying, you know what, actually God's maybe teaching something to us that we can impart to our brothers and sisters in the United States.
Yeah.
So again, that's something that I think we'll see more of in the future. But there's some issues we got to think of. Are the people who are marginalized going to become respectable?
Explain.
Well, for example, whenever Pentecostalism started,
okay,
they were despised by other Christians. There was a famous preacher called Campbell Morgan. He was the preacher at the Westminster Chapel in London. And he was actually the author of one of the pamphlets that launched fundamentalism. He described the Pentecostal movement as the last vomit of Satan. That's how strong the feelings were against this, because they were viewed as crazy. Now, today, of course, Pentecostals in the whole have become much more respectable. You know, so you have Pentecostal Christians, you can even have a Pentecostal directing the Evangelical Alliance in Ireland.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that.
So in one sense, Pentecostals have become respectable. And we need to look at some of the marginalized groups now in Christianity. What's going to happen with them? Are they going to become more respectable?
Yeah, yeah.
How's that going to look in the future? And if they do become more respectable, are they going to lose their zeal? Are they going to become so busy trying to be respectable that they no longer are getting in there among the poorest of people and preaching the gospel effectively to them?
Which would be an absolute shame and a disaster if that was to happen.
It would be a shame, yes, it would. You see, there's a pattern in church history that you see, and it's this. All through church history, God has raised up individuals and movements. And often they've been rediscovering a truth that's been lost or restoring something to the church. So think of some of the people that we've talked about. You know, when we talked about Martin Luther and when we talked about John Wesley and William Booth and Dwight Moody and Charles Spurgeon, you know, it's like God was raising up all these different movements. Now, most of those movements, when they began, they were not universally well received by the other Christians.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the established churches of the day tended to be outraged at them because we have this strange view. A lot of us have this strange view of church history, and it's like this, that through the years, God's been gradually building things up in the church and gradually restoring truths and that. But we think when it comes to our particular group, he's got it perfect.
That's always the case.
And so the next thing that comes along, we turn on it. And we say, oh, this is terrible. You know, we very conveniently forget that we were once the new kids on the block.
Yes.
And that we were looked down upon by others.
Yeah.
And so that's why even today, for example, the opposition to what we term the health and wealth or prosperity gospel, the loudest opposition to that comes from Pentecostals, who 100 years ago were themselves the ones that other people were looking down on. And you know, I think the way the church goes in the future can depend to a great extent on, are we going to keep on repeating that pattern?
Mm-hmm.
Or are we going to get alongside new movements that are coming along and try to be their friends?
Right.
And try to maybe correct if there is something that needs corrected.
Yeah, adjust it.
Not slapping people down, but trying to work together.
Yeah.
And I do think that certainly in Europe, we are seeing big signs of this. You know, one of the amazing things today is that in European Christianity, some of the most powerful forces in the church today are not among Pentecostals, charismatics, but among some of the oldest denominations.
Yes.
So, for example, for years, our church based in Drogheda, we've been taking our young people to an event in England called Soul Survivor.
I know it well.
Which is run by a Church of England priest.
Yes, it is.
And we, you know, instead, now there's no end of Pentecostal Bible weeks for young people. And yet here you've got all these Pentecostals taking their young people to this Church of England
yeah.
run event.
Yeah.
You've got the Alpha courses also developed.
How amazing is Alpha?
Yeah.
All across the world. It's just, it's been going how many decades now?
Oh,
two, three decades? Yeah, and it's just continuing. And it comes from?
It comes from Church of England.
Church
priest.
Of England, yeah.
You know, I've turned on secular. I remember some years ago, sat watching a TV program, not Christian television, and suddenly there's David Frost introducing a program called Alpha, Has It Changed Your Life? And interviewing people that went through the Alpha. And I'm thinking, this movement is impacting so many people that it's in the mainstream media as a story.
Yeah.
And it's not an American megachurch that has launched this. It's come out of the Church of England. We have the 24/7 prayer movement, which is not confined to any one denomination. As many people within traditional, long-established churches, that is amazing numbers of young people across Europe and North America and other countries are now part of this 24/7 prayer movement. So I do see some very hopeful signs that say we finally learned some lessons from the past.
Which is good.
And we're able to say, you know what, some of the new things that are rising up are great. And I thank God for some of the new ministries and new churches that we're seeing. But you know what, there's good stuff in some of the older churches as well, and we can still learn from them. And so there is a saying that says, if history teaches us anything, it shows us that history teaches us nothing. But hopefully that is not going to be the case. And we can actually learn something from our past history as the Church of Jesus Christ, and we can move forward into a better future.
It's going to be fascinating to see how God leads his church
in the years
to come, because that's what it is. It's God leading his church. I love it when churches in cities who declare Jesus as Lord come together to make a difference and to impact their community without politics, without a desire, how many people will I get out of this? It's got nothing to do with that. It's a message of hope in a place that needs a message of hope with unity from the church. If we could do that more often, how amazing would it be to see cities and towns changed by the gospel and people's lives dramatically changed?
And I think we are seeing that. And I'm tremendously hopeful about the future. I am not one of those people. I mean, I've written a book on church history, but I'm not here saying, oh, for the good old days and let's get back to the days of John Wesley or anything else. The fact is, John Wesley would have loved to have seen our day. He wouldn't have approved of everything that occurs in wider society, just as he didn't approve of everything that went on in his own society, including slavery.
Sure.
But he would rejoice, I believe, at seeing some of the innovative ministries that have sprung up. He would have rejoiced at seeing some of the powerful movements, at seeing what people like Martin Luther King achieved in the United States. I think he would rejoice at seeing the gospel being preached and growing so powerfully across the global South, about evangelistic crusades with a million people attending a single meeting that
phenomenal.
John Wesley could never even have imagined. I think he would rejoice at some of the things that we're seeing in our day. And I've hearkened back to this quite a few times because I believe it is vitally important as we say, where are we going in the future? This collapse of Christendom and the increase of a secular society, you know what? You can't fight against it. And the church has spent too long trying to fight against a secular society. You know, there's the old story about King Canute in England.
Okay.
That the king, his courtiers were flattering him. And they said, oh, king, you're the most powerful. You can do this. And one of his courtiers said, oh, king, if you were to command the tide to stop, the tide would not come in. And the king said, right, I'm putting a stop to this. Everybody, we're going to the beach. And he got all his courtiers to carry him down on his big throne, and they set it on the beach, and the tide came in, and the king rebuked the tide. Now, some people remember that story wrong. They think it's a story about a proud king.
Sure.
It's not. It's about a king showing the foolishness of flattery. And the king tried rebuking the tide, and he knew what would happen. The tide came on in.
Yeah.
Everybody got wet.
Yeah.
And they never flattered him like that ever again. And sometimes the church is like King Canute. You know, we're trying to stop the tide of secularism.
Mm-hmm.
And we wage these culture wars and rearguard actions to fight against this and fight against that to try to keep a Christian society. Sometimes we just need to say, hey, society has changed. Now let's look at what opportunities we have now that we didn't have 50 years ago. And I'm excited because I'm seeing all around me, I'm seeing expressions of church and expressions of sharing the gospel that embody that attitude, that the world is changing and the world has been changing ever since Jesus Christ was born in a manger, and the world will continue to change. And we need to accept the fact that we live in a changing world, but we have an unchanging gospel that we can present in a multitude of ways. And I think if we keep that in mind, the future of the church is going to be even more exciting than the past of the church.
Nick, it has been fantastic. What a privilege to sit with you and just talk through your book. How on earth did we end up here? And sadly, that's it. That's the last episode. But again, if people want to get hold of the book, just go to nickpark.ie and they can buy it, the paperback, or it can be downloaded as well from Amazon.
Downloaded from Amazon. Yeah,
but buy the paperback. You need the paperback.
Oh,
it's
yes,
great
it's,
to have on your
Yeah,
your
real
shelf.
Book's better, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. It is.
And you know what? The best bit of all is this, that we've covered here 16 chapters of church history over
yes.
8 programs, but the next chapter of church history is waiting to be written. And some of the people that are listening to this program today are going to help write the next chapter of church history. And that's got to be good.
That's got to be great. There's no better way to finish. Nick, God bless you. Thank you very much for everything over these last 8 weeks.
Thank you.